This is podcast number 170 for the Well-Educated Mother's Heart. Hi, I'm Marlene Peterson, and today I'm talking about the legends of El Dorado. I'm afraid I didn't learn much about our neighbors down south in school. I remember filling out a map of South America, but that's about it. So I've really enjoyed filling in the gap and learning more about them. They too have their freedom stories and heroes. But what I'd like to focus on today are their myths and legends, particularly as they are related in a 1904 book I came across called The Stories of El Dorado by Frona Eunice Waite. In her preface, she writes, "As to where these myths originated or how old they are, I have nothing to suggest, since in presenting these simple variants, it is of no concern of mine. It is sufficient for my purpose to know that they exist. To me, they lend a dignity to our country by investing it with a misty past, replete with a mythology as rich and sublime as that of any of the races of antiquity." The central hero to these myths was a golden heart who came from the East and taught the people the peaceable arts of civilization. So great was his influence on them that all the tribes had essentially the same hero in their lore, though he was called by different names. The preface opens with a quote by Professor A.F. Bandelier, who wrote, "It has only recently been recognized as a fact that on the whole American continent, the mode of life of the primitive inhabitants was formed on one sociological principle, and consequently the culture of these people has varied locally only in degree and not in kind. The religious principles were fundamentally the same among the Sioux and the Brazilians." Close quote. This hero was a bearded white man in white robes, and when he left the people, he promised he would one day return. Temples were built to remember him. Many, many generations passed, and still the people watched for his return. He had taught them of making sacrifices of the heart, and as they degenerated, they engaged in actual sacrifices of hearts in hopes of bringing him back. When the bearded Europeans landed, Columbus, Cortez, Pizarro, these simple people were submissive because they believed the golden-hearted had finally returned. What happened next is one of the saddest pages of all history, a history that's largely been erased because the Spanish priests burned and destroyed so many of their records. But I can't help but hope there will be records that will yet come forth to teach us more of these people. In another old book that I found on Internet Archive, which I regretfully have been unable to locate again, but I'm still looking, I read that at a time of great conflict and turmoil, a people had been led to a place of refuge where they were taught by, and this book used the term, celestial beings, who taught them the peaceable arts of civilization. Their place of refuge was Machu Picchu, and if you've ever been there, you know the wonder of the world that it is. When things settled down, they were instructed to take what they had learned and build a holy city, Cuzco. The story of the Incan Empire is incredible, and I'm only scratching the surface. I read how, at one time, millions of them lived in a cashless society. Can you imagine? Each person had a spirit of self-reliance, and each one looked after his neighbor's needs as well. So there were no poor among them. As I talk about these things, many of you who are of my faith will recognize a connection. For those of you who are not of my faith, I hope you won't mind if I share a little of my beliefs, not in a spirit of persuasion, but in a spirit of understanding. I believe the Book of Mormon to be a record of these people. In 600 BC, when the Babylonians laid siege to Jerusalem, there was a prophet in Jerusalem named Lehi. He was warned in a dream to take his family away from Jerusalem, and they were brought across the waters to a promised land, the Americas. The Book of Mormon is a record of their story as well as others on this continent. The culminating event to the story was the fulfillment of a promise, that a Savior would be born in a land from which they had come, and after his death and resurrection, he would visit them and teach them in the Americas. They were the other sheep of another fold, he referred to. One of the sweetest scenes I've ever read is of Jesus blessing their children. What followed was 200 years of peace. There were no wars and no contentions in the land, and he promised that he would return. Of course, I can't help but connect these legends of the golden-hearted that are common among all native tribes to this visit of Jesus in my Book of Mormon. Returning to Stories of El Dorado, back in the preface again, Frohna writes, "No words incorporated into the English language have been fraught with such stupendous consequences as El Dorado. When the Padres attempted to tell the story of the Christ, the natives exclaimed, 'El Dorado,' or what the imperfect translations have made El Dorado, 'the golden.' As the ignorant sailors and adventurers had been kept from mutiny by Columbus's promise of gold, it is no wonder that they seized upon the literal meaning instead of the spiritual one. The great heart of humanity will ever ache with sympathy for the melancholy and pitiful end of the natives, who at the time of the conquest of Mexico were confidently expecting the return of the mild and gentle Quetzalcoatl. None of the cruelties attributed to the Indian had its origin in resistance to the acceptance of a new faith. On the contrary, he fought solely in defense of his home, and from Patagonia to Alaska was always willing to listen to the Christian ideas of God and hereafter." Close quote. The natives prized the golden rule. The conquerors prized only the gold. Let me share the first chapter in Frohna's retelling of the myth of the golden-hearted, and if you'd like to read more, the book is linked in the middle school section of Latin America. Chapter 1. The Happy Island. A long time ago, there was a beautiful island close by the place in the east where the sun rises. The sea was all around it, and at noonday the sun in the sky seemed to slant just above it. Being near the equator and in a tropic clime, the winds were soft and warm and full of the odor of sweet flowers. Sometimes the sea was smooth and clear as glass, and then the goldfish and sea mosses floated near the surface and glittered in the sunlight. At night the moon came out big and round like a silver ball, and the stars shone very clear because there was no smoke nor fog in the air. In the moonlight, the queer little flying fish would jump out of the water and dart forth and back in the funniest way, as if they were playing some kind of game. Their tiny wet wings glistened like silver gauze, and when everything else was still, made a peculiar whirring sound by all flapping at once. The beach was strewn with quantities of conch and abalone shells. Also other species of all shapes and sizes, and they were as dainty in color as it is possible to imagine. The children of the Happy Island often held the larger ones to their ears to listen to the murmurs and complaints of the insects and other forms of life living inside them. This was only a fancy, but many seashells do have a soft musical cadence if we care to hear it. Some poets believe that they were the first musical instruments, and that the inhabitants of the sea send messages ashore in this manner. The ferns grew almost as tall as the trees, and there were hundreds of birds skimming through the air, or flitting through the branches, singing and chattering and having a very happy time. They were not afraid because no one threw stones at them or tried to frighten them. Everybody was glad to see them put up their little bills and ruffle up their throats in singing, or else spread out their wings and splash water all over their backs while they stood on a pebble or twig taking a morning bath. The people said that when the birds were twittering and chirping, they were talking to each other. When they were singing, they were telling God how thankful they were for the warm sunshine and plenty to eat. There was a wonderful city in the center of the island named the City of the Golden Gates, because it was surrounded by a high wall of very thick stones, with a great number of gates of gold through which the animals and people passed in and out. Here lived the Old Man of the Sea, as the king was called, and his son was a beautiful youth known as the Golden-Hearted, because he was so gentle and kind. He was a swift runner and could shoot well with a bow and arrow and was strong enough to wrestle with a big man, but he preferred to make gold ornaments and vessels for his father, and was often permitted to go into the king's treasure house to watch the workmen polish the precious gems which they found in great abundance by digging into the mountains near the city. The people knew all about white and black pearls and how to get them from the bed of the ocean. In full sight of the island was a large reef of pink and white coral, and the young prince went there many times to see the curious little insects building their graceful, airy houses over some rock hidden by the water. He sometimes imagined that he heard the mermaids calling to him. What he really did hear was the wind dashing the waves in and out of the coral chambers, as if it were determined to wash them away. The reef was an excellent place to fish, and the golden-hearted and his companions had many a fine day's sport there while the divers were searching for the pearl oysters. He fished with a dragnet made by himself, and he would let it out and haul it in again like a regular sailor. He never killed any of the fish, and the divers would not give him the pearls they found, because they were compelled to kill the oysters to get them. And this, they said, made the pearls unlucky, and was the reason why they were round and shining like teardrops. The miners brought him all the emeralds they could find, because this was the happiness-bringing stone. Its color is like the soft grass in the springtime, and they wanted him to be always young and have everything his heart desired. The royal gardens were his special care, and in them he was allowed to cultivate any kind of tree or plant or grain. Then from them he must learn the names and habits of the trees producing the best wood for building houses, what plants were good to heal the sick, and all about the grains useful for food, either for man or animals. Every flower that had a perfume grew in a separate part of the garden, and those shedding their fragrance at night only were in a bed by themselves. He was required to know the difference between single and double species, and why there is such a difference in the same family of plants. Honeybees, big-winged butterflies, crickets, and beetles hid in the flowers or flew above them, and these all taught a lesson to the young prince, who had no other books. The honeybee was an industrious little fellow, continually building a piece of comb or else filling it with honey. The butterfly, on the other hand, did not work at all, but changed from an ugly grub into a caterpillar, and finally into a gorgeous butterfly with spotted wings and bright eyes. The king told his son that the butterfly was like a soul, the immortal part of ourselves, and he wished him to be as busy as the bee and to do no more harm to other creatures than does the pretty butterfly. The cricket was a cheerful, merry chap, usually singing at the top of his voice, and the beetle tried to push all of the dirt out of the garden. If he found anything he did not like, he would roll and tumble with it, even if it were much bigger than himself. This amused the golden-hearted very much, and when he grew tired of his own occupations, he would run out into the garden and watch the beetles. One day he went into the splendid throne room where his father was giving audience to some wise old men who were foretelling what was going to happen to the king and the people of the Happy Island. They urged the king to send some member of his household to the strange land over the sea, toward the setting sun, where the people were in barbarism. The golden-hearted was much interested and thought there was an opportunity to do some good for the weak and helpless. Springing forward, he said, "Dear father, let me go. I'm able to sail the seas and am willing to devote my life to teaching these poor people how to live like brothers." The king felt proud of the young prince, but he loved him so dearly that it was hard to let him go, and also hard to refuse such a noble, manly request. "Do you know, my son, this will entail a great deal of hardship and self-denial?" he asked. "Yes, father, but God intends us to earn all the good things in life. He will not give them to us for nothing. That is his good law, which makes us happy, healthy, and wise, three of the most precious possessions in the world. Go, my golden heart, and may God bless and keep you always, said the king. Take a green-throated hummingbird for your guide, and when you find the land, journey on until you come to a place where a cactus grows at the base of a rock, and there is a golden eagle soaring in the air above it. Halt there, and found a city, and name it in honor of the sun. Then all the wise men begged to go with him, and for days after there were great preparations made for the departure of the king's son. At daybreak one morning he set sail in a snake-skin boat, and all the inhabitants came with the king to throw flowers and emeralds into the sea, because they wished to show respect to the golden-hearted. It was their method of blessing him and wishing him good luck. The whole shoreline, as far as he could see, was lighted up by bonfires, where the people burned resin and perfume to commemorate his going. At the water's edge stood the old sea king, with his long white hair and beard blowing in the wind. By his side was a cream-white horse with three plumes in the top of its bridle reins, and a square red blanket edged with deep fringe on its back. Crowns and moons and stars of gold and silver were scattered over the blanket to show that the horse belonged to the royal prince. Back of the king was a long line of young warrior priests mounted on white horses with red blankets and carrying reversed spears in their hands. They bowed their heads when the poor old father leaned over on the horse's neck and cried as if his heart would break as the boat with his only son in it pushed off from the shore. Snatching a torch from the hand of an attendant, the golden-hearted waved it on high. Fire with them was a symbol of wisdom, and when the king saw it, he answered the signal by waving a torch, and the warrior priests flashed their spears in the bright sunlight, and the people sent up a deafening shout. This meant that they were willing to sacrifice their future king for the good of a strange race of men who needed a teacher to show them how to cultivate the land and how to build cities and live civilized. The people of the Happy Island would not send a common man for a teacher. No, indeed, they gave the best they had, their dearly loved prince with the golden heart, to help their less fortunate neighbors. And he gave up all luxury and comfort because he would rather be useful than live in ease as a king. Bye-bye. See you next time.